As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. Happy 2017 to you all. This week, I'm joined by not one, not two, but three former professional footballers. I'm going to surprise them right now by seeing which one is the nerdiest of the three and which one, if I were to ask how many top flight matches have you played, can tell me off the top of their head. Cascarino?
Well, including top flight England.
Yeah, or England's not the only country in the world. Top flight anywhere.
I don't know.
Include Scotland, if you don't.
Probably to the nearest at least 200.
Scowcroft?
I wouldn't have a clue.
I do, because I looked it up. Stuart Robson?
270, I'd say.
I think you're around 250 last time I looked. You're like 350, maybe even more, actually.
That's me, Cass. Yeah,
Cass. Yeah. And you, I don't know, because my almanacs didn't go that far back. So, just kidding. We have a new manager in the Premier League, and another manager has lost his job. We'll be talking about what 2017 has offered up so far, Arsenal coming from 3-0 down, and whether that's a glass half full, glass half empty moment. But there's one place to start, and it's the Etihad. Manchester City and Burnley, a dire first half from City, I thought. Aguero and Silva on the bench. Lots of head scratching there. Before we get into, as I'm sure we will, Pep Guardiola and the madness surrounding that, Fernandinho's red card. Nobody wants to argue.
Not really. No?
Right, so please tell me this. It was about half an hour in, if I recall. What would prompt you to make that kind of tackle in that area of the pitch when you know your team is already shorthanded in terms of central midfielders because Gundogan is injured? It's the first half of a game. You're playing freaking Burnley at home. Why tackle in that way, in that position?
There is no explanation for it, only madness, really, because what was going to happen, he should have jockeyed the player. He could have run alongside him and nicked the ball off him. Instead, he threw himself into the challenge, two-footed, scissor-type movement. There is no excuse for it. Years ago, we'd have been able to get away with that. But now the rules say that you can't jump off the ground. You can't go with 2 feet like he did with his studs showing. And he had to get a red card. But I still don't understand why he does it. It could be laziness that he doesn't want to run backwards, so he goes head first into the challenge rather than chase the player back. It's reckless.
Cass, this is his third red card of the season. One of them, the Gladbach one, was a second yellow situation and I thought a bit harsh. But you know, the other one that he got was the choke on Cesc Fabregas. This is not a player who we think of as a red mist type guy.
I don't know if there's something a bit deeper at City. It feels like there's something that's not quite right, where players are seemingly... If you think of the Aguero send-off against Chelsea, that's just a mad... It's just an instinct. Why did he do it? Why did Aguero just make a really ridiculous challenge on David Luiz? Then you see the same from Fernandinho. It's becoming a little bit too common for my liking. So I'm not quite sure if this is coming from the training ground with the manager onto the football field.
Well, I rather want to throw this out there, the impression that it has more to do with the particular environment around City right now, perhaps. And I think back to, you know, the what's tackles comment from Pep, and maybe the idea that some people feel that, you know, we look like we're a bit of a soft touch here because, you know, look around, like, other than Otamendi, does none of these people strike as particularly scary, physically dominant individuals? And maybe in some way English football's perceived to be more physical, and he wants to show it and he doesn't want to get pushed around, and so maybe he goes out and he overreacts this way. Is this too much
I think there's a
pop psychology
at the moment. There's a lot of anxiety at Manchester City, and that sometimes makes players challenge rashly when they shouldn't do and make bad decisions. You know, there was a lot of anxiety in the crowd. You can tell the manager's got anxiety problems on the side of the field. One or two of the players arguing with each other. Things aren't quite right at Manchester City, and that's what happens when things aren't quite right. People make rash decisions.
On what Stuart's saying there, I was at Millwall versus Gillingham on Friday night, and there was two sending offs for Gillingham. Now, manager Justin Attenborough is under pressure. Now, funny enough, he loses his job. He loses his own game against Oxford. He gets another player sent off. And what I'm going back to my point is when sometimes when the manager is a little bit edgy or a bit spiky like he's been, the team reflect him in some degree. That, you know, they just have a reaction to their manager and the way things have been going. You lose football games, you normally find you'll get ill-disciplined with happening within the camp as well.
You know, you can see in his interview afterwards, he's totally on edge, and that must be the same at full time. It must be the same at half. Yeah, exactly. That's not just all of a sudden happened in that split second, and it does filter through to the players.
Just on this, do we think that Pep is getting away with it because he's Pep? Because you touched on, yes, he's a great manager, but is Pep getting away with it at the moment with his side and their performances and the ill discipline, or has this just been the week where it's turned?
No, the indiscipline's been there all season. And the other thing I'd say is he got the lineup wrong in the first half. Credit also to Sean Dyche. But they played really well with 10 men in the second half. He fixed it. He turned it around. And on more than one occasion, he's fixed things. I'm blanking on the game, but it was a recent one where he switched
Arsenal
to Bryan and Sterling.
Yeah, against Arsenal. Yeah. They were being not this outplayed, but they were going to lose the game.
Yeah, going to
this is called
time.
Being a really, really good manager. Making the necessary adjustments after you make
There's
a mistake.
Not too many teams will play with 10 against 11 and win the game by a goal.
And they're third in the table. You touched upon it. We can move to it now. What he said after the game. What I find interesting is that in the cold light of day, you can spin that into an absolute positive after the game and just go there and say, yeah, I got it wrong at the beginning, but then we fixed it. You know, unlucky with a red card. We're third in the table, onwards and upwards, right? But that didn't happen. And that's what I find really, really interesting. It's like, you know, the mask that managers wear after games. And you can say, oh, but they're still wound up from the game. Yeah, I know, but...
Paul Hayward made a good point, didn't he? And
I don't think so. Paul rarely makes good points. Paul Hayward's very good.
In the Telegraph said that Alex Ferguson's number one rule is you never show the press your emotion. You never let them see a chink in your armour. And Pep did that. And ever since... You know, people have jumped on it now, haven't they?
What's interesting to me about this is that, and he does have sort of the tortured soul thing going on. When I first met him a long time ago, you know, he was hugely depressed and felt that there would be no room for him in the game and for the football he wants to play because he said it had all become physical and not for people with his skill set.
Talking about as a player or a manager?
He's talking as a player. He said, if I was a young player today, you know, I'd be playing in the third division somewhere. I'd be one of those guys who stands stills and passes. You disagree with Pep Guardiola. Well, what's interesting is football's always...
You're saying it's more physical now than what it was 20 years ago?
He argued. He was arguing.
I don't think so.
No, well, okay, listen, you guys, you're not arguing with me. You're arguing with the 2004 version of Pep Guardiola who said that, okay? He was so down and depressed. It's kind of ironic that he actually, if anything, changed football to make it less about athleticism and physicality. But he does have that darkness, that anxiety. That's kind of always been there. At Barcelona, in three of his four seasons, if you remember, in January, he said, no, this job's too stressful. I'm too emotionally invested in it. I don't know if I'm going to be back next season. I mean, it's not just a ploy to get more money. He really bought into it. So I find that part really interesting. And when judged with the context of those comments that he made to not so much the NBC ones where he talked about how he didn't see himself managing until he was 60, but when he was also asked by the Spanish journalist from Cuatro at the end of the press conference about where he said, you know, City would likely be one of his last jobs, if not the last job, and whatever else. Do we think that he's sending a message or he's just being extemporaneous, just saying what was on his mind at the time?
I think he probably didn't think about it. He was caught up in the heat of the moment. He said things that he thought might have an effect. And they certainly did have an effect, didn't they? Because at the moment, he looked like a manager that's under massive pressure.
What I've sensed from the outside, from Pep, when he left Barcelona, it wasn't the end of the world, the relationship between Pep and his achievements at Barca. It always feels to me that they let him go on his terms. And the relationship with the fans wasn't as tight as what we'd all think it was. And I think it's a similar thing at Bayern. And I don't know, but from what you've said, Gab, and I've read this numerous times about Pep, is that, is he one of them guys that comes in one day, he's thinking this way, 3 weeks later he could be thinking another way, and he's never quite sure if he's going to be there for a long period, but them days in between, them dark periods when he's a manager, does it have an effect on a club?
See,
do you see what I mean by that?
Like, again, we're dangerous. That's how I feel. You're asking me to do stuff that I don't like doing because we are kind of engaging in, you know, the dime store psychology here a little bit. But I can just talk about the facts and the events. At Barcelona, there definitely were moments like that. Mm. And it was explained away by people who know him well as saying, look, he is so invested in this club and what it stands for. It's, you know, his first big club. He's obviously, you know, he's Barca through and through. He feels the weight of history and whatever else. In the 3 years at Bayern, he didn't have any particular moments like this. Obviously, he had a row with the team doctor, yeah, and whatever else. But he never necessarily got to that sort of dark, dreary place that he seemed to be in during that BBC interview.
When you have so much success, that helps, doesn't it?
This could be the first taste where he's thinking, I might not be successful. I can't turn things around. And that may be a reason for being...
Right, but then he also didn't win the Champions League.
He still won the title, so he's still winning games.
He might not win anything.
But you can't have it both ways. One of the great things he said in the NBC interview, which was overlooked because by the other hullabaloo, was that he derives more joy from the performances, from the process, because that is something that, A, he feels that he's influenced more than the result.
Any good side or any good coach, you can see what the game plan is. There's a defined game plan. And I could see that in the first three or four games. You could see the way the fullbacks were coming in, just as they did against when he was at Bayern Munich, to create space for the wide players to get easy possession out. The way they played out from the back, they created space for one of the defenders to come out into midfield. You could see that was all done on the coaching field. Then he changed it. And I now can't see, he changed from one system to another system, different players in different positions. I can't see a defined game plan anymore. And that's a worry with a manager that's now been there for half a season.
I would argue that, is he one of them guys that turned up at a club, got success straight away, winning games, looked at his back four and thought, I don't need to go and buy. I can manage these players I've got, and then realised deep into the season, the cliches are not as good, the Sanya's not as good, Kolarov is not as good a defender as he would like, Otamendi. I would argue he's probably looked at four or five.
Sometimes Zabaleta. Success at the beginning is the worst thing that can happen
to
you.
Exactly, and he's probably gone to the board and said, I do want this particular player, but we won't overpay now, and I think I can manage this group now and still win games. And that's come at a cost. That's how I see it.
But I think he's stopped managing them. Yep. In terms of the style of football they're playing.
You know, Stuart, you've been a player. Mm. We've all been players here. Sometimes you know when a player don't fancy you or doesn't believe in you. You know your long-term future at the club. And that can come as a cost, can't it, with your
and
team?
Even more worry. I was a coach for several years and head coach at Wimbledon. And you started to have... You had dark days when you thought, I can't influence the players anymore.
Yeah.
The way I want to play... They're not now doing the things I want them to do. And now I've got a problem because do I change everything? Do I change the players? Do I change what I'm trying to do? And that's when you have the problem.
I'm not as negative as you guys are about City in terms of performances. And I'm really encouraged by the fact that when he makes mistakes, he fixes them.
It could still be a very good season for him.
Yeah, and I also don't buy... People talk about how, you know, they've got the greatest squad in the history of the universe. And I said this in the summer and I got shouted at. I don't think these players are that good. I mean, if we're talking about the very highest level, I think
how many would you call world-class players? De Bruyne?
I think De Bruyne is outstanding. I think Aguero is outstanding. Still, once you get past that, I don't share the tremendous love that people have.
So who's the other world-class players in the squad?
Silva is.
Definitely.
Yaya Toure is on his day.
But world-class is an open-ended thing, right? Mm-hmm. So, but I'm not sure that these other guys, David Silva and Sterling, are quite as tremendous as we sometimes make them out to be. I think we kind of got used to almost by rote saying, oh, they have the best squad of the Premier League, when I'm not so sure that's the case. And I think maybe he overvalued what some of these guys can do. Let's talk about Sean Dyche again. When he came up the first time, I was like, well, you know, what's up with this? And then, boom, here they are again. They may yet go down, but they're closer to mid-table, certainly, than the drop. And these players just kind of work together.
He's found a formula at home that really worked. They haven't done very well away from home. He's found a formula at home where he's been brave, and he's got two centre-forwards up high up the field. He's playing from back to front. They've got centre-backs that come up and think they can win the ball in the air every set play. They get crosses into the box as well as anybody at the moment. Away from home, they don't do that because they don't always play with two up front, and they sit that little bit deeper, and they're going to be cut open.
Would they be better off, if they're just going to lose away from home anyway, would they
play
be better off
exactly.
playing exactly, exact yeah, same
exactly
way?
The same way? But most managers don't. They say, well, at home, we're going to press up, we're going to win free kicks, we're going to get crosses into the box. When they go away from home, they try and play the same way, but with only one up front.
I was hoping his voice when you said that. But, but here's the thing. People look at Sean Dyche, and I mean, Eddie Howe is the next big thing. We'll get to Bournemouth and Arsenal in a second. You never hear him mentioned as somebody who could step up to the next tier of club or whatever, or at least I don't.
I think he's learnt his lesson from the last time, which is a sign of a good manager. When he came up before, they tried to play that little bit more football when they were at home and they got beaten to it because he didn't have good enough players. This year, he's found a way, a formula, to play well at home and to be really compact defensively, but also get enough players in the front areas to score goals. So he's done very well this time around.
But why is he never mentioned among the better...
I think he's done it through the underdog, kind of through the back door, hasn't he? Maybe not as expansive, easy on the eye as what Eddie Howe's teams are. I think he will get a job, Sean Dyche, that's without doubt, and he deserves it. Can he take... Can he go to Swansea now and keep Swansea up and involve them? Can he
might be able to do that, but would he be able to go, and I presume you're saying, Gab, would he be able to go to the next level?
To an Everton, a Southampton, a club
would
like
he
that.
Be able to do that and be, and you just said...
And also and scout foreign players, bring foreign players
not be
in.
Not as expansive in his style of play. Would that be a problem for the chairman?
Well, the interesting thing, I mean, look, the top six jobs are all managed by guys that have done incredibly
well.
We're
talking about that.
There's no way getting a top six. No, but what I was going to say, Gab, years ago, if he'd have done as well as he had with Burnley, he might have got an opportunity at Spurs.
Remember they on the line. Would you rather have him as England manager than Gareth Southgate?
Yes, I would.
Yeah. I'm very, very,
very brave manager in there.
Do you guys think he would have been a better option than Gareth Southgate? I'm not going to put you on the spot, Cass, but the two of you.
I think so.
We don't even know if he would have been interested, but you know, maybe when the next, since you guys are running out of
I'll ask you a question then. Yeah. So the next mid-table West Brom job or something comes up, who's got more chance of getting it, Sean Dyche or Gareth Southgate?
It's a great question.
That's quite an easy one, isn't it? Sean Dyche.
Want to take a moment to talk to you about one of the companies that brings you the game podcast. I'm talking about FanDuel. It's one-day fantasy football. Now, you may be familiar with the concept of fantasy football, picking players, and then you get points based on how they perform. A couple things about this are different because, first of all, you're not locked in for the whole season, so if you screw it up, you can get out of it, and you kind of get a fresh start every round. The nice thing about it is it also gives points for defensive performances, so you don't just go and stock your squad with a bunch of Michael Antonios. You can play for free, or you can put some money of your own down if you want a bigger payout. I've entered the £10,000 fan favorite, which only covers the Saturday games. I did not do too well this week. You have £100 million to spend. There's no subs. There's no captains. You just put out your 11 and the right formation. I think it's actually a pretty decent test of football knowledge. And on top of all that, if you sign up with our promo code, THEGAME, then FanDuel will return your entry fee as free credit up to £10 if you don't win cash in your first contest. So it literally is kind of like playing with house money. This is only available in the UK. You have to be over the age of 18. Please play responsibly. And of course, terms apply. Remember, it's fanduel.co.uk and the promo code is THEGAME. Let's move on to the South Coast, Bournemouth and Arsenal. Talk about a game of ups and downs. Bournemouth, of course, go 3-0 up. Could have gone 4-0 up. And then Alexis Sanchez sounds his bugle, pulls one back, and then Arsenal go and end up equalizing, and they make it 3-3. Easy question for you, Cass, after a game like this, if you're Arsene Wenger, is your glass half full or half empty?
I think you'd have to portray it full, because to be 3-0 down, and they've already lost at Everton and lost at City in a manner that they did, where they got rolled over, got turned over. And whether you think the managers outwitted Arsene Wenger, which was probably the case in them particular two games, to be 3-0 down and get a draw, I think he has to look at it as a big boost, because I always remember the game, and these boys remember, especially Stuart, the game at the Emirates in the Champions League when they played Monaco, and Oxlade-Chamberlain ran with the ball back to the halfway line, plonked it on the pitch. And I remember thinking as I'm watching it, you've got 90 minutes of a replay here. Why are you going so crazy to get, and like, you know, oh, get in the box, we're going to get this 2-2. They end up losing 3-1 because Monaco scored, and they end up winning 2-0 in Monaco. And now, in some way, I think the way Arsenal were designed, it wouldn't have been out of the realms of possibility that they'd have gone chasing back to halfway and plopped the ball on the halfway line, taken it, and conceded a fourth against 10 men.
I mean, Bournemouth did have a chance.
You know, they had a great
chance.
So, to me, I'd have to go full.
Scully?
I think it's glass half empty. I didn't see the game. I was at the Palace game last night. But just looking at the scoreline, 3-0 down, you just think, oh, my God, that's awful. It's 2 points dropped, without doubt. And just listening to the radio driving home last night and the Arsenal fans, it was all negative Wenger comments. Yeah. And I just think that tells me what I need to know.
You watch the first 60 minutes and it's everything that you know that Arsenal can do so badly. You know, and you can't do that. They did it in the second half against Man City. They did it a little bit in the second half against Everton. They did it at Manchester United, because Manchester United, when they were in a crisis, that was when they were really struggling, outplayed Arsenal at Old Trafford. It was a woeful display. It looks as though they weren't ready for the game.
Why?
Well, that's most games that Arsenal lose, it's usually because they aren't anticipating what the opposition are going to do.
You have a manager who's been there 20 years. He knows this country inside out.
Well, I remember I was doing a lot of work for Arsenal at the time, or worked for a company that worked at Arsenal. And they were playing Barcelona. And he kept on saying in the pre-match, yeah, Barcelona, the best passing team in Europe. We're as close. We're the nearest thing to Barcelona. And I'm kept shouting at the... What about the way Barcelona are going to close you down? Are you going to be ready for that? What about the way Barcelona are going to close you down? The first three throw-ins Arsenal took, they threw back to the centre-half. They tried to play across the back. Barcelona pressed them and won the ball. It's as if they weren't ready for it. And I see it time and time again. And I used to listen to Arsenal's players come in on a Friday night, and sometimes we did a show, and they'd say, so what do you know about the opposition? And without fail, they'd go, well, not a lot, really. That was their usual standard answer. We don't know too much. We know that so-and-so scored a lot of goals for them. Unprepared. Ill-prepared for games.
Can I make a point? What do we think about Arsene Wenger coming out in the press, moaning about the fixture? Oh. My players are going to be tired. Do you not think that tells the players, you've got an excuse now to go, yeah, I feel tired?
Yeah. You know, he never, ever mentioned it.
I just think you might think that, but you tell your player, we're not tired, we're fine. Absolutely, not a problem. We'll
but Arsene Wenger,
so
when things go wrong...
half empty or half full?
Half empty.
Yeah, I just wondered on that. But I mean, being 3-0 down, to me...
It's a great comeback, yeah. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. But they did all the things in that 30 minutes that Arsenal can do. They can create chances. They can get crosses into the box. Giroud will win balls in the air. They need to do it more often, and they need to defend better and be ready for games when opposition press them.
Jose Mourinho famously said about Carlo Ancelotti's three Champions League titles, it's special. You know, there's only a handful of managers who've done it. But, of course, there's only one, whoever was 3-0 up at halftime and squandered it, as if it was, like, the biggest reference to Istanbul, and as if it was, like, the biggest sin a manager could commit. Do you think Eddie Howe is looking at this and said, like, this is partly my fault?
Or he'll probably look at it again. And I was watching the game, and as soon as he took off King and put on Sermon, I thought, I'm not sure this is a good move.
He likes Sermon a lot.
Yeah.
Covers a lot of ground.
But it's a different sort of position. King was threatening with pacing behind. They could then get higher up the field. As soon as he brought Sermon on, it meant Arsenal's midfield had more time on the ball, the back players had more time on the ball. And once you start allowing Arsenal's defenders more time on the ball and they're holding midfield players time on the ball, you get the rotation, you get the fullback getting forward, Monreal down one side, you get Bellerin going down the other side, and suddenly Arsenal look a great attacking side.
Right. I'm going to turn around and play devil's advocate. I'm going to put on my Eddie Howe hair right now. Okay, gee, Stuart, that's great. I realize that. Flip side is, if I don't have the extra body clogging the middle, which has been effective against Arsenal, look at West Brom and whatever else, if I don't have that, those guys are better than my guys. They have more space in which to play. And yeah, I'll have King up there, and then what happens is Koscielny boots it, Giroud knocks it down, and Sanchez scores. That's why I'm putting the extra guy on. I said, you know what? I'm comfortable. I'm comfortable with Mustafi understand. Lumping the ball, if that's what you want me to do.
I fully understand what you're saying, but I've seen Call Arsenal so much over the years that the teams that cause them problems are the teams that press them and stop their defenders playing out from the back. Then when they go long, they're not so good when they go long, Arsenal. And then you can get your two, you've still got two in midfield to get round the knockdowns. As soon as, and then they're not going to be a great side at doing that. Arsenal are a great side when they get time on the ball. They start rotating their positions. Sanchez comes in off the touchline. Monreal's going down the outside. If you stop them at source, they can't do that.
I'm fascinated by Eddie Howe because I don't think those are good players. I really don't. I think Daniels is very good. I think Wilson is a very talented player, but he doesn't play him all the time. And so I have to conclude it's down to the manager. He's obviously doing something extremely well. And I would have thought something as simple. How many Bournemouth players would start for Everton?
Well, I'll tell you one, and these, I hope these two guys will back. It's easier to play for Bournemouth than what it is for Everton.
Okay, forget Everton.
You've got 11 for everyone.
No.
There's not a lot you can do wrong.
Scully. You're the manager of a newly merged Stoke Bournemouth team, okay? How many Bournemouth players get into your 11?
Right. I'll flip it round again. I don't think too many of those Bournemouth players will come off last night and the crowd really sort of get on their disgrace, 3-0 up, drew 3-3. It's all sort of nice.
That hardly ever happens.
Right, yeah. If you do that at Everton.
Well, they've just done it against Liverpool. They've turned it around when they were 3-1 down and they won it. So
yeah, but
it does happen.
But you've played abroad. The stick that people get here, as long as you put an effort, you really have to kind of really screw up to really get stick. And if you want, even if you get stick after the game as you walk off the pitch, Scully, you don't get stick.
I was at a game last night.
Happen to you? Forget the home crowd at the game, right? But when you go home to walk your dog the next morning, do you have people waiting outside your house to insult you? When you go to the supermarket.
That doesn't mean you're still not playing under pressure.
No,
you don't need someone with an Alsatian at the bottom of your drive to feel that somebody's on your back.
So you're saying there's less pressure playing for Bournemouth than there is for Stoke.
Can I just add something on Bournemouth, Gab, which we in the media and in general have ignored the spending power that Eddie Howe's had. Now, if you go through the forwards from Afobe, Gradle, Josh King, Wilson.
But you know what's interesting?
Seven of them.
I'd like to know
where their wage bill is in the league.
You know,
they got punished for violating the Football League's financial fair play rules. But you know what's interesting, though? Most of those guys actually don't play that often.
No.
You know,
well, Ibin not played, you know? He's had loads of...
But I mean, it's Junior Stanislas doing things that you don't expect from Junior Stanislas. I mean,
I know a player, Harry Arthur. I saw him as a 9-year-old playing for Charlton's academy. He played the same team as my son, and I saw him. He was a decent player. He was probably the best player in that squad. I never assumed that he would play in the Premier League. He was never good enough to play in the Premier League. Charlton let him go when Charlton were in the Championship.
I told Gab this on the show last week. I played with Charlie Daniels at Leyton Orient, and he's a lovely lad, come from Tottenham. If someone had said in 5-6 years' time he'd be playing in the Premier League...
Agreeing with Gab then?
So if you look at Southampton... Southampton, the way they went up the league, half the players were playing in League One 3 or 4 years ago. The more games you play, the better you get. That's
right, but Southampton had a good manager, right, in Pochettino.
Well, not when they came up.
Well, no, but I'm not talking about promotion. I'm talking when they stayed up. It was Pochettino, and they also had some good additions to it. Mm-hmm. I look at most of these guys, and you ask yourself. And again, I think Callum Wilson's very good. He's also coming off a season-ending injury, and he doesn't play all the time. These other guys, who is really special? And then, other than Jack Wilshere, obviously, who didn't play last night.
When I watched Bournemouth a lot last year, they were beaten up badly at home, conceded a huge amount of goals. Tottenham did it to us. Right. Everton scored 3 there. They had loads of teams score lots of goals from them. I thought Eddie's biggest test was how good a defensive coach can he be? As in, can his side be harder to not concede goals against? And I think largely he's done that this year. He's, apart from last night, I think in general, he's managed his team much better defensively, which has enabled him. He spent very big on
forwards. But again,
him.
You said about managing his team better because we're talking other than the Nathan Aké, who also hasn't played like every game, and you know last season he was playing left back. You know, you're talking about the same crew, right? Daniels, Cook, Francis. I just find it remarkable. I'd love to be able to understand this a little bit better, how they're always there in mid-table with those players. But again, taking it as individuals.
Yeah, he deserves a lot of credit for the job he's done. Yeah. I don't think anyone would debate that.
As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
I want to move on to a guy who is now unemployed, Mike Phelan. News came through last night from Hull City. My first instinct is they're dead last on the table. Give somebody else a go. Will this necessarily come with strings attached, whereby a manager is going to come in and demand a certain level of investment, which he probably needed anyway in January? That's kind of the way English football works, right?
Yeah.
But back the manager.
The only reason I would think that, obviously not doing particularly well, but Mike Phelan probably went to the board and said, I can't do anything more with these players. I need more investment. And the board said, we're not going to invest. And you're saying that you can't do anything more with them. Well, we might as well let you go at the moment. He probably said the wrong things to the board. And he said the wrong things after the game the other day, didn't he? He was almost admitting defeat. You know, when he was talking about, well, we just can't defend and we can't do this and we can't do that and we keep giving goals away. We're in trouble. And when you hear the manager say that, that's where the board have gone, I don't like this, we'll get somebody else in. I'm not saying it's right. I'm saying that's probably what they think.
David Moyes has said similar thing, isn't he, at Sunderland. I did a piece with Bill Edgar for The Times about Mike Phelan when he signed his new deal. And I said I didn't think he'd get past the window in January. Why? I think the owner's son, who's now taken reins of the club, he has caused the massive rift between, firstly, was Stevie Bruce, who walked out in the club.
Well, he was trying to sell the club.
But selling the club, but you're still trying, for a manager who thinks his credibility's on the line, Gab, Mike Phelan's had to walk into Stevie Bruce's shoes with no money, not even a squad at the start of the season, worthy of being in the Premier League, start really well, and then when it does fall apart, which it has done, because you start losing games on a regular basis, you're not going to win many. And now Mike Phelan knows he's got nowhere to turn. And it's come at the cost of his job. It was always going to be like that, Hull. He was never going to be in it. Even when they'd started brightly, I always felt Hull was ready to go wrong.
In the games that they won, they were hanging on.
The games, obviously, they're not totally getting outplayed, are they? It's just real schoolboy errors that are costing them, really. But I don't think the board have looked at that and think we'll get someone better in who can keep us in. I think his Samuel Eto'o quote's almost a little bit of a, "Well, you're joking, he'll never come here." I don't think he endeared himself too well.
But it's a normal response, though, isn't it, James?
Yeah, I think he's a good guy, and I think he knows that he's done as much as what he can with that group, and I just can't see them.
It tells you a lot when a manager walks out in the summer when you've just, you're in the Premier League.
You've just got promotion.
He's just got promoted, and he's going, I'm off. That tells you everything you need to know what's wrong with Hull.
Especially that manager. I mean, given that he was relegated with them, they stuck with him, and he took them back up. Which, by the way, I mean, it's an argument for another time, but we mentioned him. We mentioned Deitch, obviously another manager. You know, sometimes if you believe in what a manager's doing, you know, we often see this in mid-season, right? People say like, oh, no, but it's a disaster if you go down to the Championship. It isn't, because in this day and age, but look at the riches of the Premier League. You know, the fact of the matter is most teams, certainly teams like Hull, unless you've got, a lollipop signing the contracts, there'll be relegation clauses in the contracts. If you look at the number of teams that come back up, I think it's something like 6 out of the last 15 relegated sides. And obviously where the wheels have come off and things have gotten difficult in that list of 15 teams that kind of disappeared into oblivion, you know, you've got teams like Blackburn, you've got teams like Fulham, teams like QPR, teams that have much deeper issues. But if you think your manager's on the right track, even if you're going to go down, a lot of times it makes sense to keep him. If you like what he's doing, if you like the way he works, if you conclude that we're only...
Obviously Norwich fill with Alex Neil, but exactly. He's struggling at the moment. So now the crowd have turned on him.
I don't buy into it. Going down, it's easier to come back up. I think it's very hard.
I'm just going
to
say something. You know what I've realised, and being around football clubs and being around managers, and especially in, these boys know that I like them go to games in League One, League Two. Do you know what? It's amazing what happens between the board and a chairman. The directors who might voice their opinion on a manager that ends up dividing a group, a board. And that can be a real issue at football clubs where Alex Neil at the moment might have, I don't know, there's 10 on the board, 5 with him and 5 against. But do you know, it changes week by week. And I'm saying this because I know Johnny Steele at Dagenham. He went to the board at Luton and apparently it was 4-4. There was 8 board members. And he walked because... He wanted a majority, not four. He didn't want 4 people against him in the boardroom. That is a dynamics of a lot of boardrooms, that they're with you and you think they're with you. And when you hear these comments of, oh, the board, yeah, we're backing our manager, it probably means, well, at the moment, he's slightly got the edge on the board, but it not also, everybody.
I don't know, we talk about boards. I think that's relevant at some clubs, no doubt. I think at a lot of other clubs, it's completely irrelevant because the board is just a bunch of flunkies and you've got one guy who owns... 100% of the club. What?
Name names?
No, but it's when people talk about, like, you know, people talk about the United board. I mean, what board? It's Woodward, his mate, and the Glazers, right? There's no board, right? I mean, it's not like it's the Greek Senate, right? And say the same thing at City. I'm sure there is a board at City. In fact, I know there is, but there's no board. It's Khaldun. And, you know...
they do get affected by people around them.
Of course. But everybody does. But it's more about persuasion
those days
and compulsion.
Gone, isn't it? Where it's a sort of a local owner and he does have a board.
That's all done. I want to move on to another club that have one local owner, Hugh Jenkins. I'm assuming he's local because of the way he spells his first name and because his last name is Jenkins. and 2 majority owners who are American. And a ton of other owners who are the Swansea Supporters Trust. They've appointed Paul Clement. Obviously, a guy who's been around, spent time as an assistant at Bayern Munich, Real Madrid, and Chelsea, of course. So, and Paris Saint-Germain as well. Mm. That is quite the...
Where's he going to bring Ancelotti's his assistant?
How cool would that be?
he's coaching players.
He's worked with some pretty good players. and he obviously has a trust of, you know, a top international coach. He's had a go at management before, but that was in the championship, so I know nothing about that. I assume because he's still not there, it did not go well. Nope. Discuss.
It didn't go well at Derby. And I saw their last 3 or 4 games at Derby, and I said earlier on about how when you watch a team, what's their game plan? What are they trying to do? I saw a Derby side that was all over the place, and it was the worst I'd seen them play for 2 or 3 years. And I know 1 or 2 people at Derby, so I'd seen them a lot. And the players were going down in their performances. There was no pattern of play. There was no sort of seemed to be a game plan. And that's something. When you're the assistant, you can get away with it. You keep players happy. You take good sessions, maybe. But are you the real coach? Are you the one that's making all the decisions?
Well, to be fair, we don't know if we're not there, but I would assume in the Clement Ancelotti dynamic, normally you think of Ancelotti as being the good cop. So I would assume Clement would have had some level of... Unless they're both good cops. And
I mean, in terms of who dictates the tactics, who dictates the game style, I would imagine obviously. Ancelotti does it.
He
says to Paul Clement, go and coach this. He's the manager. He's got to make all the decisions himself.
The biggest difference is the psychology coaching, isn't it? Mm. You've got to be... He's got to go into Swansea now. Is that the guy? Actually sat right behind me last night. He's the one that's got to get into those players' heads.
Clement sat right behind you.
Yeah. I don't think it's going to be a training session. Oh, lads, we're going to do this training session, and this training session is going to keep us up. I think it's how can you get that extra 20% out of those players, the Gylfi Sigurdssons of the world. And, you know, they've got some good players, Swansea. How can you do that? And that's the good managers can. I'm sure all three of us have played.
Intelligent people learn more when they don't have success than when they do have success. Obviously, he went through that at Derby. Do we think, is there a reason to believe that he would have learned from that would have been a learning experience.
We don't know Gav at the moment because his only one experience he's had has been, it was okay, I think it was fifth when he lost his job, but it was in a pretty rough period.
Yeah, that's a stupid question. You know. Sorry, again, championship question. Mm-hmm. Isn't fifth good? What do they do? Like,
Derby were expected to have been expected to go up for the last three or four years. Yeah. McLaren almost took them to the top, and then he lost seven out of the last eight games, and that's why he got the sack the first time round. Yeah. Then they appointed, I think it was Clement was the next manager. Then they've appointed Pearson,
Sorry. So if Clement takes over after your mate Stevie Mac has lost seven of eight games,
at the end of the season.
So Clement had the whole preseason.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. And they're in fifth place, and they're not happy, and so they...
Well, they started off badly. They lost. They didn't win for their first six games, and hardly scored a goal. Then they went on a great run, and then over the Christmas period, they then just lost four or five on the trot. Yeah,
yeah, they had a bad, bad run.
And they lost to Manchester United. Remember 4-0 in the Cup, was it? And at home, when they played...
See, we're all looking, he's a coach. We only know him really as an assistant, mainly, because of the clubs you mentioned at the start. Now... The biggest challenge always is for a coach is to become a number one. And that is a different job. Yeah. You know, I haven't been a coach, but I've been at great clubs where we know guys we've played with in football who have coached in football, they'd be a great number one or they'd be a great number two.
I played under Don Howe for years.
He was
I played him as a coach and he was a good coach, an excellent coach. I would say I learned load of tactics off him, but his sessions were always excellent sessions. The players loved it, all that sort of stuff. When he became the manager, he lost all that for some reason, and he didn't seem to be able to man manage, didn't want to make some of the big decisions, and he lost the players to a certain degree. Yeah. Whereas he was an excellent coach, but when he went up to number one, he wasn't the same person.
Percentage chance, and in light, of course, of their victory over Palace. By the way, I'm wondering, are you seeing Palace actually win this season when you've seen them in person?
He's the Reaper.
No, I haven't. And they were very poor last night.
Did they win when you were playing for them?
Occasionally.
How many games have you been to?
I haven't been to many.
This season? Three, four?
No. It's my third game last night.
And they've lost all of them?
Yeah.
Yeah, Steve Parrish, if you're thinking... I don't know.
That's not going to get any straight.
You might want to reconsider. Or maybe send Scully to some other games.
Well, to be fair, they've only won four games in all of 2016.
Fair point. Most definitely not a bad luck charm. We're not superstitious here. Knowing what we know about their victory last night, percentage chance Swansea stay up?
For me, 20%.
Scully?
35%.
25% I'll go with Swansea to stay up.
We're all pretty negative towards Swansea's chances.
Yeah. The average is around 27%. Sounds about right to me. Right, let's move on to some quick hits. This is where I'm told that some people don't remember the rules, so I'm going to have to go through them again for their benefit. I will ask a question of our panelists, and they have 20 seconds in which to answer. After 20 seconds, they will hear a sound effect. Think of it as a bit of a warning sound, like this. And after 25 seconds, you will hear lightning. If you keep talking after that, I will start shouting and being unruly, and you don't want that. Liverpool twice take the lead at Sunderland, and twice Jermaine Defoe equalizes from the spot. Cass, can we chalk all this up to the three games in 7 days and Sadio Mane's bad judgment?
Well, Mane's judgment, obviously, with the handball and... You know, just that moment that you can get something madly wrong. I think Liverpool have to take a big positive out of the week that they've had, really. Beating City, you know, and they're performing. They're a good side.
Speaking of Sunderland, they ran themselves into the ground and actually, I thought, played rather well. Yet they're stuck deep in the relegation zone. Stuart, other than spending his way out of it, what can Moyes do in the here and now to turn it around?
First thing... He's got to work harder with the back four. Saw them against Burnley where they were all over the place.
No more Donald Love.
It's not a case of who they pick in terms of working with them, making sure they do the right job, not two players going for the same ball, not being too square. I think they need to get the ball into the front areas that little bit quicker at times, get support to there, and then try and be more creative in the top third of the field. And I think he's got to stick to a tactic. He's got lots of injuries at the moment. Stick to the same tactic, use different players, but make sure he knows exactly what, or the players know exactly what he's trying to do.
They looked to me like a team that were pretty well drilled and certainly up for it, working really you know, worked really hard.
You can't
say
the same when they played Burnley. That was a dire performance.
I did not have the pleasure of watching their match against Burnley. Manchester United win 2-0 at West Ham as Mike Dean makes everyone unhappy. Scully, you can either revel in six straight wins or you can join the crucifixion of Mike Dean. It's your call.
Definitely talk about reveling six straight wins. Can't be bothered about Mike Dean. United are doing well at the moment, although they were average against West Ham, I have to say. But six straight wins, they look like they've got a bit of momentum going, don't they? The gap is closing now. Liverpool have dropped points. Arsenal have dropped points. Be interesting second half of the season.
Top four finish?
50-50.
Oh, come on. Yes. Show a little bit of faith.
Yes.
Watford lose at Stoke 2-0 and they have 1 point from the last five games. Cass, is this just because everybody seems to be injured at once or is there a broader reason? They're sinking like a stone.
Well, it definitely has a massive impact on a football club of Watford's stature where they lose so many players. I thought it was a massive test going to Stoke because Stoke have gone with Peter Crouch down the middle, a little bit more direct, and Mark Hughes has attempted it. And they caused a few teams problems, Liverpool, Chelsea. And I thought it was always going to be one-way traffic for Watford, and they need players back.
How did Crouch play two games in 3 days like that? I mean, what? Was he well rested? Like,
absolutely.
I was so impressed. Stuart, I can't work out Everton. I've asked this question last week. I'm thinking I'm going to continue working it out, asking it every week. I don't know if they're actually any good, even after their 3-0 win over Southampton. So, as I said, I don't know who I asked last week, but somebody definitely less clever than you. So, I'm more interested in your answer.
I think they're an average side.
Was it you, Scully, I asked last week?
Alisson Rudd.
Oh, sorry.
I think they're an average side at the moment. I've always thought that Koeman, when I saw him at Southampton, played some really good football. They pressed the ball in midfield. They counter-attacked well. They were creative in the top third of the field. I can't really see that from Everton at the moment.
And they're evolving into something else.
I saw them against Arsenal where they played poorly for much of the game and then started, the crowd almost inspired the team to press higher up the field and work harder to win the ball back. I think Koeman's just struggling at the moment.
Crystal Palace fall at home to Swansea and Sam Allardyce is rather unhappy at the fixture congestion. He wants the person responsible for it sacked. Which I thought was kind of funny, because isn't it a computer? What does he want? Somebody to go, like, smash up the motherboard? No, I'm kidding, Sam. I'm kidding. I know exactly what you mean. It's obviously the TV companies who are at fault, the ones who also pay everybody's wages. Scully, does he have a point here? And when do you begin to worry about your former club?
I think he's probably got a bigger job on his hands than what he realised. It was a really poor result for them last night, I have to say. I thought they would definitely stay up. I still think they will, but it's going to be it will go to the wire with them. Yeah, they've got some problems, Crystal Palace, that they need to turn around, maybe get one or two in a transfer window. It just needs freshening up.
Can I have a special bonus-related question on Jason Punchin specifically? Because I read something online from one of those analytics types who talked about how Punchin is playing deeper this season. He's taking a bazillion more touches, but he's shooting and assisting and doing all these things a lot less, presumably because he's further away from goal. Now, I get that can happen when you're older, but do you want Jason Punchin to be the guy turning into a midfielder?
No, you don't. I don't really see him as a central midfield player. And last night, there, Joe Ledley, Punchin, Kabay, three very, very similar players, all came and got the ball off the back four and sort of passed it backwards sideways. Yeah, you know, I think they need a bit of protection in front of the back four and they need someone further advanced so they can sort of closer to Benteke. You know, Benteke is their focal point. They need someone very close to him, gambling off him.
Is Benteke doing enough? I've seen games where
he's
not winning balls in the air. That's what he's aiming the side to do, win balls in the air.
But to be fair to him, he's very, very isolated in that team at the moment.
Added Zaha,
though. Zaha, for me, is their best player.
I know he got a great goal.
I think if they're not careful, Palace, they'll lose him. Because I just think he can make things happen. Sometimes, you know, his final delivery or something, but he gets it. He can get the team up the pitch. He's exciting. He attracts two or three players over to him because you can't really leave him one-on-one because he will go past players. I think he's turning into a good player.
Gab, one for you. We've had Oscar and then Tevez and now George Mendes claims Cristiano Ronaldo turned down a €300 million move to China, which would have paid €100 million a year. Are you buying this?
No. I think we're kind of in the realm of fantasy. I know you can look at this and say, because Tevez is making squillions and Oscar costs this much, then surely Ronaldo could cost that much. But I think there is a limit. The nice thing is Mendes can say this stuff and it's believable. Right now we're in the situation where China, anything's possible. But it's funny because if you go and you take a closer look, all the big moves of China have something in common, and they have one guy in common. But there's only three letters in his name. So, Kia.
Oh, Kia.
So, anything's possible. It's a fascinating story, and it would have made for a tremendous story, which we would have never heard the end of. Many, many, many thanks to my guests today and all ex-pro lineup in Tony Cascarino, Stuart Robson, and the very excellent James Scowcroft. Now remember, it's just £12 for a 12-week trial. If you want to subscribe to The Times, all you need to do is search The Times online. You can also press that subscribe button. It's even easier. And if you do it via iTunes, then please leave a review, as long as it's a nice one. We're going to be back next week at the usual time, or rather, I won't be back because I'm going to be away. You'll be in the company of Alison Rudd. That's right. No Max Rushton. Sorry, Max. Till next time. Bye-bye.
The Game is brought to you by The Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh, no,
I don't,
yes.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.